Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well then, we finally got back to winning ways as we beat Aston Villa for the first time in 44 years. It was also a win that arrested the slump that saw us lose two games in a row for the first time under Roberto De Zerbi. And it was also our first win in six since beating Roma on the 14th of March. And despite missing the first penalty of his career, João Pedro's header from the rebound was his 20th of the campaign. On Saturday, we faced a long trip north to Newcastle for what will be a last away game of the season. Let's hope we can continue the winning habit in an Avrian derby of sorts against the Magpies. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to be joined by two people whose unlikely friendship helped soundtrack the within years, and also without whom we may not have had a club at all. So please welcome an accountant who is about to hang up his calculator. It's Paul Samra. And joining Paul is a man unlikely to ever retire. It's John Bain, who is, of course, usually known as Attila the Stockbroker. Now, we didn't tell you each other was on.
That's brilliant. It's absolutely lovely. As I was saying before the start of the... Basically, this is the first time we've actually seen each other since two completely coincidental meetings on the train and various other places... away and in the restaurant, away in Amsterdam and Marseille. Because it was obviously, Paul sits in the library and I stand in the North Stand. And he doesn't drink, so he doesn't come to it. Well, maybe he does, but he doesn't drink at, he doesn't drink in Dick's Bar, which is where I go. So, I mean, so never the twain shall meet, which I suppose is a kind of a metaphor for the incredible, wonderful friendship from two people from completely different kind of cultural areas of life, which was the perfect combination in the battle to save the club. You know, Mr. Nice and Mr. Nasty, or Mr. Complete Nutter Liability and Mr. Sweetness and Light Organisation and Rationalism. But it's wonderful to see you again, Paul. And I'm now going to shut up for a couple of minutes and let anybody else get a word in edgewise.
So for our kids that are listening, anyone who's under the age of 40, who probably doesn't appreciate the double acts that John and Paul once were, and probably still can be again if absolutely necessary. Paul, tell us about how you came to know John and how he came to be such an ally.
Goes back to the mid-90s where the accounts were under my close scrutiny, as were the board, and things emanated from what was being said by the directors, the shareholders, the Bill Archers, the David Bellottis, the Greg Stanleys of this world.
We have told you about swearing, Paul.
Yeah. what was evidenced by what was written in the accounts. And
I can actually...
with some forensic analysis of the figures, it was apparent that they were the directors were charging excessive interest on their loans, that the FA hadn't been told of the change in the articles, whereby on a winding up, the surplus would be distributed to the shareholders, whereas the original articles was that any surplus would go to a sporting institution in Sussex. That became known as the no profits clause, and the no profits clause had been dropped. That's what got the campaign all the attention, because the press were able to pick up on it in a very neat summary by saying the no profits clause. So along with everything else that was going on with appearances at the High Court, the board became more and more and more discredited, and the FA got more and more involved.
Do you recall, bearing in mind that this has had to be a multi-pronged attack or multi-pronged process and protest? There's obviously the evidence that you had to gather, the facts and the information you could present to people, and then, as John has said, because you sit in a library with a calculator, is this the way you hand the details on to John and say, right, John Hill? Do you remember your first time meeting him?
I think it was at a pub, Chapman's in Worthing. And
no, it wasn't. I can absolutely, sorry to interrupt. No. I literally can remember the first time we met. It was when we invited Stroke Force, Greg Stanley, to come to the Concord to one of our Beza meetings, where Greg Stanley said, the Albion will go to Portsmouth, wherever it was, over my dead body. And obviously he was talking complete nonsense. And there, and this was actually before, this was definitely before the Article of Association that Paul so brilliantly sort of forensically identified as being changed, and everything that he's just said, this was before that.
Yeah.
So there was Greg Stanley making a complete idiot of himself. There was Ian Hart, myself, the great late great Roy Tudor, and I believe still at the time Peter Kennard, kind of like sitting there, basically a combination of just laughing at him, swearing at him, and saying, you know, this is completely ridiculous. And there in the front row was a bloke in a suit looking very intense and angry, but at the same time totally controlled and from a very different kind of culture. I just went up to us afterwards, because I always do, and I said, hello, mate, you obviously want to get involved in this. And that was it. That's absolutely how I remember it. And I know that is the first time we met. It was at the Concord on a Monday night in 96, but in the obvious bit, I don't know when it was, maybe even 95. Was it 95? God almighty.
It was 95.
Yeah,
I think it was the old Concord, don't forget, as well.
The old Concord. It was 95, and that's where we met. And we forged from that moment. I saw in Paul someone of incredible intelligence and dedication, who was also, crucially, who was forensic and had the job, the profession that was needed to really sort those individuals out.
Mm.
And it was brilliant. And I have such huge respect for Paul, especially because he came from the other half of society, really, and we needed both. We needed to be absolutely in your face. We needed to be out there, but also we needed to be absolutely sharp and completely aware of all the facts. And Paul was such an integral part of the saving of the club. I cannot describe how much we owe to that man. And to be fair, the club have paid him the tribute, which is brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually got it written down here, John, and actually maybe you should write this yourself, actually. It's called The Ballad of the Accountant and the Punk Rock Poet. It is
No, I mean, this is the point. I mean, obviously this is the Albion story. Here we are at the end of our seventh season here in the Premier League. We've had our first season in Europe. We can be so pleased and grateful for who we are. And there's obviously a lot of people who don't know the story. And I'm not necessarily talking about locals for whom they were too young. That's, you know, that's just a happenstance. But I'm talking about people who, you know, we're, given the global reach of the Premier League and people in Africa and Asia and America, they just see this new team that came up and now they're getting into Europe and they're climbing the table and they've got an avant-garde coach who's doing stuff that, you know, the best coaches in the world aren't doing yet, and yet do not know the backstory, do not realise the things that have happened in the last 20, 30 years that have underpinned how we got to where we are. Now, it's easy to point out, well done, Luton Town, absolutely brilliant. That they've,
brilliant.
To be honest, they shouldn't have crashed as far as they did, but they did, and they bounced back, good for them. But they never had an existential issue. We did. We were not only about to go out of the Football League, we were about to go out of existence. So everything that I think that anyone's...
We didn't get their ground as well, remember?
Absolutely. And we lost the ground and we, you know, and nowhere wanted us. We were toxic. We were poisonous. No one wanted, you know, Bill Archer had made sure that we were unpalatable. And yet here we are. And I think that for me, the story must be told. Even if people who weren't there are bored of it, or I'll stop sort of hitting us with this, you weren't at Hereford stuff. Well, fine. If you weren't at Hereford, you weren't at Hereford. But we must keep telling this story. Must be humble to who we are.
I'd like to try and sum this up, because I have done quite succinctly, believe it or not. First of all, if you're under about 20, maybe 25, 30, you'll have there's absolutely no problem. Especially if you're really young and you're just starting in your life as an Albion fan, there was absolutely nothing wrong with the fact that you have only known the so-called successful years There's no reason for you to have experienced anything else because you weren't there. You weren't physically alive. So there's no criticism or anything. It's great if you look back. If you don't want to look back, that's fair enough. If you're from another country, and this is an interesting point for me, because for a long time I just dismissed them all as plastics until some guy in Africa on my Attila page said, hang on, mate. Okay, I live in Africa. You know, some of them live other countries all over the world. And you call us plastics, but the players who come and play for you are from our countries. So how can we be plastics? And that was a crucial moment in my football life, because I absolutely rejected that epithet from then on, because he's absolutely correct that, you know, they have every right. Now the football is a global game. I'm not quite sure. I don't agree with some aspects of it, but it is a global game and players come from all over the world. And those people from the countries from which the players come have every right to come and support our team. More than a right, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome them. And what's even more inspirational is when the Japanese are still coming, when Mitoma hasn't played a game for season. And I've actually walked up to a couple and said, thank you. I know why you came in the first place. It's absolutely brilliant that you're still here when your hero is going to be out for, you know, the ones I've got a real problem with, and I'll put it straight right now, of people of our age or not much younger who were there all the time while we were fighting to save the club, and they would say, oh, I support Man U, or, you know, the Brighton, they're just, you know, word that you can't say that is found in the toilet. Why would I want to support them? You know, blah, blah, blah. Who bought their kids, Southwick Green down the road, who bought the kids the fake Man United and Liverpool shirts to play football, you know, who didn't care. Then when we saved the club and we started soaring up, those same people, our kind of age, oh, I've always supported Brighton. You know, now, you know, I know, you know, I know, you know, blah, 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 blah. Now, I'm not saying don't come. I'm not saying we're better fans than you. What I am saying is, for heaven's sake, because we lose a few games, because we've actually got 9 players out injured, it's not because the coach has suddenly gone mad. It's not because we're suddenly playing bad football. As I've said so many times, if the singer and guitarist of a band are ill, the gig is cancelled. If all our best players are out injured, we still have to play the fixture. You know, if a singer and guitarist of a band were ill and the gig had to go ahead and the replacements were not very good or not as good or maybe even slightly less good, people said, oh, that's not very good, is it? You know, people would laugh at them. It's obvious. Yeah. Exactly the same thing. You take Caro Matoma and Solly March and Joao Pedro and Ciso and all the others that are originally out of our team, right? It's not going to be as good. And anybody who tries to pretend that there is any other reason for what has gone wrong this season in the latter half, other than the fact there are injuries, frankly, is a lemming.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, John, I mean, we're going to get onto the video game shortly, but Paul, I mean, obviously, John was talking about our newfound foreign fan base, and myself and Alan have been absolutely delighted to like host shows featuring the stateside Seagulls, the Australians, doing shows with people in Zambia. It's absolutely incredible how we've come to this point. But also, John was also very much involved in something at the forefront of that, when we had Fans United and we had fans from not all over the country but all over Europe coming to support us in our time of need, didn't we?
Absolutely, and the power of the internet and social media has really helped move the Brighton story far and wide. And you know, we need fans, and you know, let's face it, we lost a generation of supporters during the war years, and it takes time to build that up. We're thankful that the ground is usually full, certainly in terms of season ticket holders, with the waiting list, you know, 30,000 plus physically there, probably about 28,000. But that's still damn good because you've got income from 30,000 plus, and long may that continue. I think the issue about the story and not letting I believe that new fans and, more importantly, new players should know the story. Mm-hmm. Because we are a special club. I know that fans of every club say they're special. No club, as John alluded to, has gone through what we have gone through. No club has had a chairman that has got blue and white running through his veins because his family has been involved for two generations. You know, we are a special club. We've been saved by Dick and his consortium. We've been saved by Tony Bloom and the stadium, and we move on. And our chief executive is highly lauded and praised, wins award, and the company, the club, the business wins business awards, charity awards, left, right, and centre. And it employs hundreds, if not thousands, on matches of people. And it's a fantastic employer. And it's almost rivaling American Express in Sussex in terms of numbers of people. So, you know, it is an amazing success story. But I do think that people and players should know the story because it will make their passion even greater. I mean, my son's Toby, who is 19, as John alluded to, you know, hasn't known anything other than success. Sebastian, who's now 25, you know, largely missed the war years, and, you know, it's history to him. But he knows it inside out, and Toby knows it inside out. And it's up to that generation to tell the story and pass it on.
Yeah, we should point out that Sebastian did actually make his Albion Roar debut back about 13 years ago in the dungeon.
And I also remember Sebastian by Steve Harley being played out of Withdean.
Thanks, John. That was John doing that, yeah.
He always denied it and said it was you.
Well, I played it as well, but John had introduced me to it.
Oh, well, I see.
Shall I tell you something else? I remember Toby sitting, aged about 2 years old, when we were doing the PA. That would have been at Withdean.
2007, that would have been.
Yeah. I remember him sitting. You brought him to a game, and he was sitting in the box on the desk while we were doing the PA. Yeah. By then, you know, we had Zamora. We were going places. I mean, look. I mean, the point about it is, I am not blaming. I mean, I want everyone to support the Albion, and there's no problem. Everyone is welcome. I actually wrote a poem about that once. Obviously, I wrote poems about everything. But the point about it is, where I have a problem is where people who are relative latecomers who are of an age to remember what we went through and know where we've come from, then kind of not sneer, but do down all of us lot who went through everything and fought for it and say, well, you know, it doesn't matter what you did. What matters is that we've lost two matches in a row or we haven't scored a goal for a month. You know, that is completely ridiculous. The only reason that we are not playing as well as we did for the last couple of years is because half our team is injured. There is no other reason. You know, you can't get away from it. And anybody who says it's an excuse, that's like saying, well, I've cut the half my leg off and I can't walk as well. And someone says that's an excuse.
You know what, John? I mean, I did this TV show on after the game on Sunday, and the presenter was like, he basically wanted to criticize us saying we're in free fall, how bad we're doing. And I said, yeah, but you can say all that, but we're on the cusp of in our 124 year history, we're on the cusp of our third highest finish ever. And it's like, you know, it's just a little bit of perspective.
There's the perspective, and then there's the context of it. Is and then this is I think I'm probably just about to go into.
I just think you should bang on over and over again about injuries. Like, this is the reason. It's just injuries. It's nothing else. It's just injuries, injuries, injuries. When all the players are fit, we'll be in the top seven, top six. If we don't sell anybody in the summer, we sign two players. I reckon we'll get in the Champions League next year.
Wow. So with that in
mind, isn't just showboating. I mean that.
Well, we have every opportunity to do so, but Paul, I mean. Given that the statement that John's just made there, that we're going to win the World Cup, the Grand National and the Eurovision Song Contest.
No. Paul, that's Paul's job winning the Eurovision Song Contest.
Actually, yeah.
I'll be in the pub.
But when we were sort of like...
It's semi-final tonight, John.
Well, this is actually... I'll come back to you in a minute, Al, but I don't think we've asked Paul about that, because there was a wonderful picture of you in the Argus recently.
Oh, yes.
From a certain song contest that was held? By the way, was it at the Dome? Won by some Swedish
no,
pop
forget,
combo.
No, all bets are off, mate. It was the Barnet, wasn't it?
50 years ago, ABBA won at the Dome, the Eurovision Song Contest. And 24 hours before, they had the dress rehearsal. And there I was, a 15-year-old, and I produced my old scrapbook. And I managed to get two members of ABBA who walked down on our side of the railings to sign my book. And the immortal comment, which I always remember, was came from Benny, who turned to me and said, "Do you know who we are?" And I said, should I say yes and pretend? And I thought, no, best not. So I said, "No, sorry," as I proffered my autograph book. I said, "Sorry, I don't know." And he said, "Well, we are ABBA from Sweden, and we are going to win the Eurovision Song Contest." Signed the book, as did Agneta, signed my autograph book 24 hours before they became worldwide superstars.
Fantastic.
And that's a true story. But I also got Olivia Newton-John's autograph as well.
Oh, that's
did you get
really
physical?
Not fair. That's really not fair.
Anyway, Alan, you were about to make a point.
I was just going to ask Paul. I mean, I'll let Paul answer first because we've only got an hour on this show. Is when you were going through those war years, and obviously that you and John and others like Roy and Sarah and Ian and what have you all spearheaded it, Adrian Newnham. When you were sort of going through all this nonsense, and there was obviously, I think that probably Fans United, oddly enough, marked out the kind of the bottoming out. We didn't sort of fall lower than that, even though we were terrible, even worse the next season. And obviously then sort of the rest of the season built to towards Hereford and everything like that. But there were times when you sort of just hit the despair. And so while you're going through this, I know a lot of Brighton fans were thinking, is there a way out of this? Are we ever going to be able to do this? Now, without admittedly you having your own crystal balls, would you have ever sort of even contemplated, right, in 20 years' time, we're going to be doing this, 25 years' time, we're going to be playing in Europe? Or was it really just a case of, look, let us just scrape through to the end of this season?
That's very, very interesting question. I very naively started a sheet of paper typewritten with offers of money from supporters to rebuild the club. It was immediately apparent that I was putting down £100, £500. I think the total on that sheet was barely £10,000, which even in those days was not enough to start a new Brighton new album. And I then fairly quickly realised that all we could do was try and influence and get regime change. There was no way we were going to raise funds to change the ownership, to buy the owners out. It was not going to happen. All we could do was mobilise the fans, get the story out, get the truth out, discredit the board, and actually reduce their options such that a knight, dare I say the pun, on a white charger would come forward and do the real financial deal and get rid of the shareholders. And that's what happened. And from that moment onwards, in terms of the stadium and getting the stadium, and you know, I chaired the campaign for the new stadium. I was worn out with them. Getting the club back to Whitby, and I left that to Adrian Newnham to run and bring home the Albion.
And a brilliant job he did.
And he did fantastically. And that was the Trojan horse that got us on the right side of the council because we were keeping our promises. But again, at that point, I realised, yes, I'm chairing the campaign for the new stadium, but I'm certainly not raising funds to build the thing. I'm just trying to secure planning permission. That was what our aim was, and John and the rest of the team, Paul Welch, who sadly is no longer with us as well, you know, Tim Carders, Bill and Jan Swallow, Peter and Wendy Neer, all these people on the group for the Falmer for All group, it was all about just securing permission. We weren't going anywhere near finance.
But my point was, my question really was that when we were going through the war years, could you have ever envisaged, I mean, it was always been the sort of fantasy, you know, after a couple of whiskies plan that, hey, we're going to take on the world. But could you have ever seen it coming, even when you were going through the latter stuff?
Not at all. We would have been happy. We'd have been accepting of a situation where we were still a league club, playing in Brighton at Withdean until such time as someone was able to wave a magic wand and transform our fortunes. But having that belief that we had a club that someone might come along and be interested in for the right reasons was what sustained us. And we had, and let's face it, Withdean was one of the most successful periods in the club's history. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, and we recognised people, and, you know, the criticism of the Amex, you know, the fact that we're in a different league, we're literally in a different league, we're a different club to what it was. But actually, during the Withdean years, we had some amazing times.
Absolutely,
absolutely wonderful. Probably the most successful of our, in terms of trophies, of our history.
But conversely, John, then at the end of the Goldstone, where Paul says he couldn't see sort of, you know, us doing this.
You hit it absolutely. That's just what I was going to say. For me, I wrote that crucially, after Dick Knight had got control. I remember hearing that we had finally got Dick Knight onto the board, that Archer was going to go. And as we know, there was Dick Knight in the stands representing a new future for the club when we played Doncaster. And I knew he was going to be there. And I wrote Goldstone Ghosts after about five pints in, I think, 2 days before that Doncaster game. And it was then that I decided, having written that I was also going to do the banner, which was the back of another battle banner, which had loads of other stuff on it. So I just went to the pub, got some paint, painted the back of the banner. So I got the banner.
Went to the pub and got some paint.
Okay, not in the pub. Anyway, in answer to your question, and I will be uncharacteristically brief. The moment we got Dick Knight in charge, and we had forced Archer out of that position, which was done mostly by our shock tactics and at the centre for dispute resolution. Those are the two things together, because those people never ever give their power away willingly. You have to make them concede, right? And that's what we did. We got the concession. The moment we got that concession, with the incredible creativity of our fan base, the knowledge that we finally had someone with some money who could combine with our energy and our passion with the reality of the finance that was necessary, I then thought, we'll be back. I actually genuinely am not that surprised that we're in the Premier League, and I'm not that surprised that we're doing what we're doing now, because we've always been a really well-supported, well, not always well-supported, but with the potential for really great support in a really creative and unusual, different part of the country with a different attitude. And I knew that once we had got Knight in charge, that we had the opportunity to surge back. And I didn't think it would be this good, but I knew that it would be good because of the potential and the fan base.
Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is of course brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us another lovely shirt. I actually really like this one, actually. And who wants to have a go at describing this?
It's a sort of a crimson red, predominantly, with blue, a very dark navy blue, under the arms, going right down to the bottom of the shirt, great big stripe on either side under the armpit. And then the sponsored logo above the number is on the front of the shirt. This is number 14. The word above and logo is Tostem, Tostem.
That nearly sounded so rude.
In white letters, white capital letters on a black background, And then either side of that is a green stripe. So it's like a green-edged scar with black and white, with white writing. And then the club badge is like a deer's antlers.
Yes, it is.
I think. And also the sponsor is Kashima, K-A-S-H-I-M-A, on the short sleeves, which are trimmed with white and black edging against red crimson.
So do we have any ideas what this is?
No, can I just say, before anyone guesses, that's the most complete description I've ever heard on the Albion Raw. It was brilliant, it's actually, Paul. Thank
it is
you.
Brilliant.
It looks more like a cricket shirt to me, or, you know, one-day cricket
It does look
cricket
a bit crickety, actually. I'll put you... Any ideas who it is? I mean,
The only thing I'm saying is because this, it says Kashima as a sleeve sponsor, and I think it says antlers on the badge with the rest of it scrubbed out, I'm assuming that I reckon because of that, it's a J League club.
Yeah, I'm going to say J League.
There's a team called, I don't know, Large City in Japan, Antlers, then I'm going to go for that.
I mean, just to let some daylight in upon Magic here, I do know that Phil did this very, very last minute. So there's no actual photoshopping in this shirt. And the team is actually Kashima Antlers. Kashima Antlers. Antlers. And it's like, here is your show of the week, chosen for no reason at all, other than it's a great brand and it looks good. And it's a 2000-2001 home shirt of J1 League side Kashima Antlers. The J1 League is a top flight of football in Japan, and Kashima have been ever present since the league's formation in 1993. Home is the 40,728 capacity Kashima Soccer Stadium in the city of Kashima, which is on the eastern coast about halfway up, or indeed halfway down, of the main island of Honshu. Kashima are by far the most successful team in the J-League, with 8 league titles, 20 domestic cup wins, and in 2018, they won the AFC Champions League. Japanese clubs love to have a club slogan, and Kashima change theirs every year. This year is Football Dream. Hang on! No idea. Brazil has provided Kashima with more than its fair share of players and managers over the years, with Zico, Edu and Jorginho, just three of the ten former managers hailing from Brazil. Zico and Jorginho also had spells playing for them. Struggling to find any links to the UK, but there is a link to the Albion. Karu Matoma speaks the same language as most of the Kashima fans.
That's flimsy, isn't it?
That is a bit flimsy, but you
it's
know, I mean,
of interest. I'd forgotten. What was the name of the club that Matoma came from?
It was Kawasaki Frontale.
That's it. Right, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. But, so another J League club. And before that, he was at university trying to work out the hip movements of defenders. Yeah,
a dissertation in dribbling, which is common. Yeah. That's a phenomenal thing to do.
You do that every time you leave the Evening Star.
I knew you were going to say that.
And of course,
that was telegraphed.
And of course, with the current, obviously, we did the summer series in the States last preseason. This summer, we are going to Japan. So it's just incredible. I mean, Alan, myself, we met some Japanese fans. We've met many of them because they're always at the Amex and all the away games, and they're absolutely wonderful. But they're not just coming in from London, or they're actually flying over from Japan, especially. It's
planet-wrecking
incredible.
People. And also to find English-speaking Japanese fans is actually quite difficult, as we found. No. You'll have to go back through the archives to hear that particular story. Now, okay. Mr. Samra.
Hang on, Al, before we move on, I just want to say thank you to everybody who donated to the Reverbathon last week. It was great. Myself and Alan, our first live radio show from the studio for the first time since lockdown.
Great,
which is
fun.
Wonderful. Absolutely brilliant. Of course, you can still donate. So you can just go to radioreverb.com, hit that donate button, and help keep this brilliant radio show in operation. Now, Alan.
Mr. Samra, indeed.
Hello.
I mean, I'm sorry, that wasn't follows on from AD's Please Donate, but Mr. Samra, can you please donate? Yes. Now, you've been an accountant for the last, since the abacus was finally thrown onto the bonfire. And the word on the street is that you're hanging up your spreadsheets, but you're not giving up completely. So You have a project that you want to bring online before the end of the year. Tell us all.
Yeah, I have retired as a partner in my firm, Moore Kingston Smith, having been a partner for over 30 years and worked with them for over 42 years. I'm still acting as a consultant and still doing various things for the firm. But in September, I am driving with a very good friend a refurbished, reconditioned NHS ambulance, which will be stocked with pharmaceutical supplies and delivering it to Ukraine. It's part of a convoy through an organization called Medical Lifeline to Ukraine. And in fact, in September, they've done a number of convoys. Over 52 ambulances have been delivered. But actually, this one in September is going to be a mega convoy of over 25 ambulances to beat the winter and deliver the ambulances to Lviv. Obviously, we'll take advice from security officials at the border when we get to the Polish-Ukraine border as to whether or not we do make the journey onwards to Lviv. Should take about 4 or 5 days, depending on breakdowns. And we're raising money to buy the ambulance. The pharmaceutical suppliers are donated by various pharmaceutical companies around the country. And if you go on to Just Giving and look up Paul Samra, you will see the page with all the details and a picture of me in the driving seat of an ambulance. So I get to press the buttons for the blues and twos.
Tell us about the convoy. Where are you starting from, and have you got kind of a rough route? And is there any, you know, how do we apart from the Just Giving, how can anyone else get involved?
It's going to start through London from Putney, and then we drive effectively down to Dover. The freight journey, it goes freight with lorries, the ambulances, and that's been donated. And then we go through France, Belgium, Germany, Poland, down to the border, nearest border to crossing. And we then drive for 2 further hours into Ukraine, and we make our own way back, having delivered the ambulance to the health workers in Lviv. And so the money raised does not in any way paid for our return trip or anything like that. It's all about buying the ambulance and about reconditioning it.
Yeah. So, Paul, how did you actually get involved in this, and what made you want to help?
My very good friend Douglas lives in Putney and knows the chap that's organising it and has been involved in previous convoys. And I just thought, yeah, it's brilliant. I'm really quite excited by it. It should be, as long as the fixtures work out kindly for us.
Well, you know, in September, there's an international break.
it's not during the international break. But we leave on a Sunday and we should get back on a Friday.
So when you're talking about medications, what are we talking about here? Are we talking general medications or are we talking about stuff that's specifically for war zones?
There'll be oxygen, there'll be tubes, there'll be bandages, there'll be plaster of Paris. There'll be war wound medications, all boxed up, all sterile, and it will fill the whole of the back of the ambulance.
So the money you're looking to raise, it's specifically for kitting out the ambulance itself to make it roadworthy.
Yeah.
And
pay for the fuel, because, of course, it's about 1,600 miles to drive to Ukraine. With defibrillators, dressings, and equipment, and we hope to raise £15,000. So that's the big target. And I'm very grateful to the Albion's chief executive. Big shout out to Paul Barber, who has kindly made a donation. So we're looking for funds.
So just quickly remind us in that case, Paul. How do people donate towards this?
If you go on to Just Giving, justgiving.com, and then in the search function, just put my name, Paul Samra, and you will go straight to the page where all the details are, and you can make a donation as little as you want. But if you are a taxpayer, please tick the box that you are a taxpayer, and we can get 25% more through gift aid. We need to have the money in place by August, and I'm very optimistic that we will hit that target.
That's fantastic. Well, good luck with that, Paul. That's absolutely amazing. Right, but on to the actual pitch then. And we actually got back to winning ways this Sunday. Obviously, it has been a bit of a slump with the form of late. And obviously, yes, as John has alluded to, the injuries have been pretty spectacular this season. But this performance was more back to ourselves. There was more vim and vigour than we'd seen for quite a while there, Paul.
The team effort. It was a team effort. Was non-stop. When you look at the highlights, I think we chased every ball. It was a marked difference from what we've seen before. Two or three players challenging, running in, running off the ball, calling for the ball. I mean, I know that the squad had a team bonding exercise earlier in the week, and certainly it showed, because it was a different team from start to finish. They really worked for each other. And that's all you can hope for. All you can hope for. I'm delighted for Webster, and really played his socks off. Adingra is turning out. He's learning. They're all learning. They're all young. And the players that have replaced the engine players are youngsters. And I'm sure in the wider scheme of things, they were never intended to play the number of matches that they have done this season.
Yeah, I mean, John, I mean, we've seen a lot of Simon Adingra this season, probably possibly more than we would have done if we hadn't had so many injuries. And his form has fluctuated. He was absolutely on fire beginning of the season. He went off the ball a bit, went off to win the Africa Cup of Nations, came back, was great for a couple of games, but then he's just not really been great for a while. But this was him back to his best.
Yeah, I mean, I have complete equanimity about what's happened, in the sense that we had a brilliant start to the season, and then obviously two of our most important players went off to play for their respective countries in their respective competitions, and then everyone got injured, and that's just what happened. Now, I mean, I have a particular view of modern football and the amount of money and the amount of resources available to each club. And we are not in a position, not just in a position, we are never going to jeopardise the financial future and the security and the sustainability of the club for short-term nonsense connected with players getting injured. So once we got a lot of injuries, I knew that we weren't going to be as good on the pitch. And what happened on Sunday was a difference in, I mean, for a start, this season we've been a lot better at home than away. But there was a substantial, and I've missed very few games, home and away, this season. And I can say that from my point of view, there was a substantial increase in the level of, kind of connectivity between the team. And we were back to our best passing. And the bit that is the real problem, the midfield, we never really replaced McAllister and Caicedo. We really did need, I've always thought, you know, quite apart from the injuries, we needed one more really good midfield player. It's the same, we didn't get Mohamed Kudus. There was issues, I know, which were off the pitch ones. He seems to have been the kind of player who had done very well for us. But in the context of everything that happened with the injuries on Sunday, we played really well. We probably should have won by more than one goal against a good team in the same situation. They've played far too many matches. They're not particularly, they don't have a particularly wide, big depth of the squad. And we were both in the same situation. The two previous games, obviously, we were playing, you know, teams financed by slave states and hedge funds who've got unlimited resources to buy anything they want. And that is the difference. That is the problem with modern football. If you're financed by a slave state or a hedge fund or an oligarch, then you're in a different league when you get into the situation of injuries and World Cup, you know, for different competitions, the players are taken away, which makes the whole thing a bit of a procession. But we are doing our very, very best to surf it. And, you know, if we hadn't had the injuries, I think we would have had the panache and everything of this season, because the algorithm can give us so much, and the sustainability and the whole succession planning can give us so much. But then if you get 9 players out injured, the whole thing is wrecked.
Yeah, I was going to say that the frustrations have been for fans that haven't seen our journey and get spoiled, are actually our set pieces, defending and attacking, have not been brilliant. And I've always thought that if we're not in the league of the oligarchical state-run clubs, I think there are goals to be scored and to be defended against in set pieces. So I think that's number one. Number two, injuries. The frustrating thing is the injuries seem to have been on the training pitch.
More than on
the actual playing pitch, which, you know, the fans don't see. I mean, we saw Marches, but we haven't seen the others injury. You know, Mitoma, after that horrendous, outrageous foul by the Sheffield United, and he got up, walked away and played a stormer in the second half. You know, but actually, 2 weeks later, he's injured. So they're frustrated.
The back injury, you know. If it had been a scrotal injury, I'd have understood it, but it was an injury.
Yeah. I understand that Carew had been playing with an injury for most of the season with an issue with his back. So actually, it was something that just came to a head. And actually, that game against Sheffield United was actually the best he played for quite some time, ironically.
Can I just put something into context here is also is, yes, we've had injuries, absolutely, and they are a perfectly legitimate thing. But I want to put this into comparison. Now, this is our first time in Europe. And when you've got clubs of not dissimilar size to ours, and I'm thinking when Birmingham City about 20 years ago, you had Burnley, you had Wolves, you had, even West Ham. When they got into Europe, they really struggled in the league. They were relegation fodder. And in fact, a couple of clubs did actually fall through the trap door. And yet, if there is some spreadsheet that says, right, how did the teams that had their first ever season, who are of a given size, had their first ever season in Europe, how do they do in the league? I reckon we must be right up there. Yeah. I mean, here we are bouncing around mid-table with plenty of excuses/reasons. No, let's get rid of excuses. They are reasons that we didn't, you know. All right, the team, the players on the pitch at times could have done better. You know, when you look at how we defend, because we haven't really lost that many defenders. And yet sometimes some of the goals we concede are howlers. But in the great scheme of things, we're doing pretty well in the league, considering this is our first time in Europe. And it's not just the extra 8 games that we've had on the back of that. It's the distance we've travelled, the exhaustion gone with it, and the excitement. And like I say, AD, with the first game against Athens, for instance, we played the occasion, not the game. We were all caught up with it, and you can't help feeling that the players were too. And given that football is also about a lot of mental preparation and a lot of mental aptitude, it's going to be always difficult to do what they did. I could argue, ironically, that actually going out to Roma probably did our season a favour, even though we haven't been brilliant. If we'd have carried on playing, I can't help feeling our league form would have been even worse.
Well, I mean, I was just looking. There's certain things about this performance, though. I mean, obviously, again, there was a lot of personnel missing, but there are things that we've been doing that which we hadn't been doing for quite some time. So we were getting the balls into the box earlier, and they were looking dangerous. We were playing like slide rule passes. I mean, Dingra put that one on the plate for Pascal, didn't he? And then he did it. Was it Dingra who played the ball for Pedro? I think it was. Put him through, and when he should have scored.
Sorry, AD, while we're at it, VAR, don't get me started on that again.
I'm coming to that bit.
Come on, let's do it now. Let's rant.
But I just wanted to say, how many more goalkeepers are we going to make look absolutely amazing this season? Surely it cannot be a coincidence. Because, I mean, everyone to a man says Robin Olsen is absolutely terrible. All of the other fans were saying, oh, yeah, he's going to score a hat-trick today. And he was absolutely incredible.
I know. But actually, getting back to along those lines, getting back to John's point, we haven't replaced McAllister and Caicedo. Listen, if Manchester United or Real Madrid had them and lost them through injury or sales or whatever, they'd struggle to replace them, let alone the fact that we had the glory of watching those two play together last season is something we should always behold.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. In fact, the fact that our recruitment gave us those two players is beyond belief. And I do believe that in maybe another year, Baleba could be kind of a Caicedo on speed. I mean, because he's got a lot of the defensive qualities, the sort of defensive midfield qualities, and he's also got a great burst of speed going forward. He just needs more time. Because I can tell you that the people I know in France, you know, in Lille and elsewhere, I've talked to, think he's a real, real prospect.
Well, the difference between Caicedo and Baleba is that Caicedo had his opportunities to bed himself in the under-23s, in the PL2. Baleba, on the other hand, has been thrown in at the deep end and has to make his mistakes in the first team, not in the reserve.
Caicedo was on loan to Beerschot in the Belgian league near the bottom two seasons ago, remember?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you know, he wasn't...
And he got recalled halfway through, yeah.
Yeah, he was playing for Beerschot at the bottom of the Belgian league. And that, you know, I mean...
It's also actually along those lines, in that particular season, that's when the first time we saw Mitoma, and he was only ever coming on as a sub. You know, he gets 15 minutes cameo, of which I think he still scored about sort of 15 goals that season.
I think he scored a hat-trick coming off the bench for USG.
He did, yeah. I think a 15-minute hat-trick coming off the bench, giving USG a massive win. Of course, he was playing alongside Undav as well.
He's coming back next season.
That's going to be interesting. Undav coming back, having done really, really well. He is a natural goal scorer, the like of which you see rarely. The problem with Undav is that he doesn't contribute an awful lot elsewhere. And if he could be, but if he can manage the right way and give him with the chances, he could be really good next season.
Yeah, let's hope so. Now, Alan, you've got a bet noir about VAR in this game.
Yes, because I am convinced that the lines that the VAR used were between Pascal Gross and the Villa defender. Now, if that was the case, then yes, I would accept that Pascal Gross was offside. But what they didn't do is pull the camera out a bit further and actually see where the ball was played from, which incidentally was about a yard further forward. I would have said that the ball, it would have been very, very tight between the ball, where the ball was played from, and where Pascal Gross's most offside part of his toenails might have been.
Well, it might have been his knee. I don't think it was his toenail. I think it was a bit higher up. But there you go.
Yeah, his knee, John, his knee. But the point is, they didn't do the lines from the right place. And it just, I mean, I've some considerations and problems with VAR, and most of which are nothing to do with the original idea behind it. Most of my ball aches about VAR is the utterly inept people who have decided, you know, they're the ones that are going to use it. I mean, it's your original Luddites trying to use computers who have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in theory, it should be better next year because they're going to the automated system, which is the one they used in the World Cup and they generally use in Europe. But I mean, we all know that. I mean, we don't like VAR, but it's here to stay. There's no two ways about it.
Apart from in Sweden.
But the bottom line is what needs to happen. It needs to go back to IFAB and they need to like readjust the laws of the game in order to like facilitate it. Because I still think the laws are okay as they are. Well, no, because it's like at the end of the day, if our view is, and I know that Paul agrees with this, if you can't tell someone's offside with the naked eye, then it's onside. And basically they need to relook at the way that the law is interpreted, because we all know it was there to stop goal hanging. It's not there to be micromanaged in the way that it is.
It just needs
to be tweaked in such a way that it's fairer to the attacker. Yes. I don't know whichever way you want to look at it, but it needs to be tweaked in order to make it more relevant to the 21st century.
But I think that the law itself is absolutely okay in that sense. What you're asking for probably does exist. It's the application of it.
Yeah. Paul?
Well, you're damned if you like it, damned if you don't. I mean, you know, the issue had been that linesmen were making wrong decisions. And, you know, the benefit of TV replays, you know, you were able to pillory the linesman, sorry, the third official, whatever they call these days, and the referee.
Assistant referee.
You know, now, actually, we move all that vitriol and their useless to the VAR team. Yes, I think it would help if they were mic'd up, the referees, much like rugby. It's quite interesting that it's noticeable that the referees, when it does go to VAR, are talking to the captains. I mean, that's a change over the last few months. I've seen
No, I agree.
The referee
yep.
goes over to Dunn and he goes over to the Villa captain and he's telling him what he's hearing down his piece. And actually, that's a very civil conversation that is going on. And if we were able to hear that, I think that would help quite considerably. But, you know, humans are involved. Humans involved, there are going to be errors.
And I'd like to come in at that point and say precisely, Paul, the fact of the matter is we're forgetting the most important aspect of the whole thing, which is that football is entertainment and it is a visceral experience. And for all of us of our age, that moment when the ball hits the back of the net, you look to the referee to make sure that he's pointed towards the centre circle. You look to the linesman to make sure he hasn't got his flag up, and then it's a goal. To take that away and turn it into some sort of slide rule exercise, it's like, you know, it's like deliberately stopping it. You obviously know what I do for a living. It's like me having to stop performing while the audience sits there in silence for 5 minutes. Well, I don't know.
Well, you're explaining a gag.
While I'm going for a wee or something. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. I don't think VAR should happen, and I think the reason it happens is because of the commercial pressures of the slave states, and oligarchs and hedge funds that now run football. I far prefer the old days when the referee made a decision, the linesman made a decision, if they got it wrong. But in those days, of course, football was for the people in the stadium rather than the people on the television or in the global market.
Well, the referee did make a decision in this game and he did point to the spot, which I thought was, well, actually, having looked at it again now.
Don't you dare use that S word, AD. Don't use it.
It was a surefire penalty.
Thank you. That's better. It was soft. You know me. There's no such thing as a soft given. Penalty.
I mean, actually, well, I thought it was soft at the time. Having looked at various different angles of it just now, I thought it was. But I don't know why. I mean, obviously, even with João Pedro's record, I just felt this horrible feeling he was going to miss. The way that Olsen had been playing during the game, I just felt that he kind of like his number was going to be up. And so it proved. But he was there to score his 20th Albion goal of the season, which there's not too many players have done at the top flight in one season, is there, Al?
I don't think any Brighton player, whilst we've been in the top division, has ever scored 20 goals in a season. I think the closest was Michael Robinson. I could be wrong. I know it was certainly 19 league goals he scored one season, and I don't know if any of those were also include cup games. But I've got a feeling this might be the highest return of an Albion player whilst we've been in the top division. And considering it's his first season with us, and even then, another one who looks like he's taken a little bit of time to mould into what De Zerbi wants from him. The difference between him as a part of the whole, you know, sort of labyrinthine maze of the way that we attack, the way he played at the beginning of the season compared to how he is now. That run, it's so underestimated. The run against Manchester City that resulted in the non-penalty, the farcical non-penalty. He actually weaved his way through about six Manchester City defenders. No one does that. I mean, he has the potential to be something a bit special for us.
No one does that apart from Carew.
Can I just also point out, getting back to VAR, what was quite funny in the game was obviously Villa had an offside goal. Now, it's clear that John McGinn was offside. So clear. I mean, the flag went up and everything. And you could see, this is the hilarious thing, Pascal Gross, who was clearly closest to the referee, losing his rag You could almost, whatever it is in German, I'm sure, John, you could actually apply this to us. It was offside. Of course it was offside. Why are we waiting for this? God damn it, man. Get on with the game. It was off. Can't you? It was offside? It was offside.
Es war, es war, um Gottes Willen, das war abseits, keine Frage. Bitte, ja, jetzt weiterspielen.
Yeah.
How rude was that? I've no idea.
It's rude at all.
It's bad inside.
It
sounded pretty tame to me, but
right, we are. I'm sorry to say that we're getting very close to the end of the show now here. So I just want to go back to you, Paul, and if you can just recap how people can get involved with the project that you're doing in September.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan. Yes, if you'd like to go on to Just Giving and look up Paul Samra, you'll get a link on Just Giving to our charitable bank account, and we will then gift aid your donation. However small, can be £5, £10, however much you generously would like to donate for a medical supplied filled ambulance being driven by myself and a very good friend to Ukraine in a convoy in September. We need to raise £15,000. I think we've got about 3.5 at the moment, and it's only been launched a week. So if Paul Barber can very generously donate, I'd be really grateful as any Albion fan. However small the donation, it would be really greatly appreciated. So just go on to justgiving.com.
And of course, we'll put all this out on all of our socials as well, Paul. So if you can help, please do. It's a fantastic cause, and you know, and it's well needed. But that is all we've actually got time for this week. So thank you to John Bain, Attila the Stockbroker, to Paul Samra, to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Cheers. Bye.
Lady, it's simply the candle is burning slow for me. Generate me limply. Can't seem to place your name, Shelley. To rearrange all these thoughts in a moment is suicide. Come to a strange place, we'll talk over old times we never spoke. Somebody called me Sebastian. Your Persian eyes sparkle, your lips ruby blue, never speak a sound. And you are so gay, with Parisian demands, you can run around. Your view of society screws up my mind like you'll never know. Lead me away, come inside, see my mind in kaleidoscope. Mangle my mind, love me sublime, lose. You're not gonna run, babe, if only it just began, babe, to compromise. Slagged in a Bowery saloon, love's a story to Syrian love. Pale angel face, you are shadow, and glitter is out of sight. No courtesan could begin to decipher your beam of